Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, as usual, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And we've got a very interesting podcast in store for you today. The timing of this podcast is of interest because it really could serve as a companion podcast to our most recent podcast, which was with Jimmy Moore about his new book, Cholesterol Clarity. Jimmy Moore is the Living La Vida low-carb guy, and he just wrote an excellent book called Cholesterol Clarity. And our guest today is Justin Smith. Justin has written a book entitled 29 Billion Reasons to Lie About Cholesterol. He's also produced a great DVD called Statin Nation. And he comes to us today from West London. He is a personal trainer, sports massage therapist, and nutrition coach. And in 2007, he set out to write a book about common nutritional myths. And he became particularly interested in issues surrounding cholesterol. At first, he was going to devote a single chapter of his book to this subject, but he got really impassioned about the diet-heart hypothesis and some of the myths that we succumb to about cholesterol and our overdependence on statins, and the rest is history. So he is his degree is in engineering, and he has a scientific background. And that enables him to critically evaluate published research. So without further ado, here's Justin Smith. Justin, welcome to Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It's my pleasure. So tell us a little bit about the Statin Nation DVD.
Sure. It's so there's a 63-minute feature-length documentary film. And that really, there's three key points in the feature documentary. One is that the benefits and risks associated with statin medications, we've been misled about them. So the benefits of statins have been exaggerated grossly, and the risks have been played down. So we've not been properly informed about all of the risks associated with statin medications. And then in the film, we talk about the so-called link between the amount of cholesterol in the bloodstream and our risk for heart disease in particular. And we show some evidence to really raise some big questions about the whole diet-heart hypothesis, or some people refer to it as the cholesterol hypothesis. The other thing that we cover in the documentary is the background to the situation. So how we could have gotten into this ridiculous situation where millions of people, more than 40 million people around the world, are being prescribed a medication that is almost certainly doing them more harm than good. So we have people like Dr. John Abramson from Harvard Medical School discussing the background to the problems and how the research is mostly done by the pharmaceutical companies and the other fundamental problems that medicine is facing at the moment.
Isn't he the author of Overdiagnosis?
Yes, Overdosed America.
Overdosed America, excuse me.
Yes.
The idea being that, he's an eminent medical doctor from Harvard, that we're medicalizing a lot of problems, and we're treating problems unnecessarily with heavy-duty medications that have unforeseen side effects.
Yes, exactly. And so he discusses, first of all, how around 80% of the research is now done by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. And, of course, if you have a commercial company researching their own products, it's not really a great surprise that it's about five times more likely that the result comes out in favor of their products. And this is sort of key and a fundamental issue to not just statins, of course, but all kinds of medications, in that this means that the drugs companies own the data. So they really control what gets published, when it gets published, and just as importantly, what doesn't get published. And then, of course, they have quite a lot of influence over the medical journals. So I think most of the general public see medical journals as this sort of pristine, gold standard, peer-reviewed publications. But in reality, the editors of medical journals, of course, are under a huge amount of pressure from these commercial interests as well. And anyone who wants to understand that in more detail, there's a very good book by Richard Smith. Richard Smith was the editor-in-chief of the British Medical Journal for 25 years. And he wrote a book called The Trouble with Medical Journals. So, it doesn't sound like a particularly catchy title, or the sort of book that would be, you know, in sort of popular demand. But if anyone does have an interest in that area, that book would explain in a lot of detail the fundamental problems that exist with medical journals at the moment, and why something might get published in a way that it really shouldn't be published in that way.
Well, you know, it's of interest that on this side of the pond, the former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, Marcia Angel, also quit in disgust. And she is not a proponent of complementary medicine, vitamins, natural lifestyle, but she's a big critic of the way that medical journals are influenced by drug companies.
Yes.
So, okay, let's break it down. There are really two main parts to this argument, and you focus on this in the DVD Statin Nation. One is the cholesterol hypothesis, and two, are statins warranted to treat cholesterol, and do they make a difference? So let's look first at the cholesterol hypothesis. You have some pretty distinct ideas about that.
Yes. Well, really, when you look for the evidence, well, it's actually very difficult to find any evidence that a raised cholesterol level increases the risk for heart disease. And this, of course, started with Ancel Keys in the 1950s when he published his graph plotting the six countries that he said, where you find an increase in the consumption of fat, you also find an increase in the risk for heart disease. And it's quite widely known now that he sort of cherry-picked those six countries that happened to show his straight-line relationship.
Also, I think he relied on wartime data. So it seems that, you know, the fact that a country may have done better during wartime, where food was scarce and where people worked hard, and that doesn't necessarily verify that cholesterol or saturated fat is the culprit.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And then there were some unfortunate experiments done on animals where they took animals which normally don't consume saturated fat or large amounts of cholesterol. And they fed them that kind of diet.
So you feed them like a rabbit butter, you know, the rabbit will get a heart attack.
Yes, exactly. And I think they also did some experiments on hamsters, I think, as well.
And you will find plaque in their aorta, and then they displayed this. And they said, this is proof positive that this is what happens in people.
Yes, exactly. And I think, they couldn't get the same results in dogs, because obviously dogs are meant to eat animal-based foods, and I think they had to remove the thyroid to get similar results in dogs.
Hmm.
But it's a ridiculous set of experiments anyway. But unfortunately, you know, there was a whole side of sort of tidal wave of pressure, and the idea that saturated fat and cholesterol clog up the arteries, obviously, as we all know now, became sort of popular. And this sort of consensus, if you like, well, it was actually an artificial consensus. They had a meeting, and it seems that some fairly key influential people had already decided what the result of the meeting was going to be before it actually took place. But actually now, since then, we've got all kinds of data to completely disprove the idea that a raised cholesterol level increases our risk for heart disease. And in fact, when you look around the world at different countries, for example, there's the World Health Organization MONICA project that monitors cholesterol levels and all kinds of health data. When you look at any graph that shows the risk for heart disease in a particular country and the average level of cholesterol, there's absolutely no straight line correlation whatsoever. The line is literally all over the place. There's no meaningful correlation that can be drawn from the data at all. And even more worryingly, there's a very strong correlation between low cholesterol levels and a reduced life expectancy. And this connection has been known about in the elderly populations for some time. And the supporters of the cholesterol hypothesis sort of try and explain this away by saying, well, yes, we know this correlation exists, but we think that there's something about the disease process that lowers the cholesterol level rather than the cholesterol level contributing to the problem.
Yeah, I guess what they're saying is that, you know, if you're sick and dying, you might have a poor liver function. So this does not apply to healthy people. We can lower people's cholesterol to 100 in a healthy person, and they'll still be healthy, not like someone who might be about to succumb to leukemia.
Yes, but of course, but we also now have studies that have monitored people for 15 and 20 years. So, for example, there was a study that looked at around 100,000 people in the San Francisco area, and they monitored them for 15 years and found that people with low cholesterol had a high rate of infectious disease. There was another study published in The Lancet in 2001, and they found that people who had low cholesterol maintained over a 20-year period had the worst outlook for mortality. In addition to that, there's also studies from Japan that they looked at people between the ages of 35 and 70 and found a very strong correlation between low cholesterol levels and increased mortality. In fact, when you look at deaths from all causes, you find that more than twice as many people died with low cholesterol as opposed to high cholesterol. So, you know, of course, we don't know exactly what's happening with this correlation between low cholesterol and increased mortality, but these studies have monitored people for an extended period of time and have included middle-aged people as well. Surely, you know, in my mind, that's telling us that it's not simply just happening as part of the disease process, but there may be more to it than that.
And in particular, there's some concerns, not just among the elderly, because I see many very, very healthy. I mean, I just saw a woman who is all of 94 in my office, and her cholesterol is darn near 300. I think it's 290. It was 298, and yet she's absolutely free of cardiovascular disease. Suggesting that the elderly at least may be exempt from this rule. Now they say, oh, maybe middle-aged men are more. There's more of a correlation between high cholesterol and cardiovascular disease, but in women. There's a concern because we're now treating women very aggressively. We recognize that we have not offered women optimal cardiovascular preventive care. And so we're making a big effort to get a lot of women on statin drugs to lower their cholesterol. But there's some concerns that in women, high cholesterol may not be such a hallmark of cardiovascular risk either.
Yes, exactly. I think personally, I don't think it's a risk factor in men or women, but there's even less evidence for women than there is for men. I think a lot of the confusion comes where men are concerned, because obviously naturally cholesterol levels increase as we get into sort of middle age, and then as we get older, then often the cholesterol levels tend to reduce, and it's those elderly people who are able to maintain their higher cholesterol level that tend to live longer. So I think this sort of natural pattern that I don't think anyone fully understands at the moment why that happens, but this pattern of sort of increasing cholesterol levels and then cholesterol levels often tapering off it as we get into sort of older age, I think that's confusing the issue somewhat.
We tend to think of cholesterol as the gunk that clogs arteries. And in fact, you know, when you do an autopsy on someone who's had a heart attack, you'll actually find cholesterol deposits in the arteries that are blocked. But what are some of the positive functions that cholesterol might have in the body?
Well, I think increasingly many people are coming around to the fact that the cholesterol is actually part of the repair process. So I think because obviously all of the focus and all of the resources have been placed on lowering cholesterol levels, we still don't have a very good understanding of actually what does cause cardiovascular disease. But because cholesterol is used as part of the cellular repair process, that's one of the reasons why I and many other people believe it's found at the site of atherosclerosis. Of course, a large proportion of the cellular membrane for every cell within the body is made up of cholesterol. There's something quite unique about the structure of cholesterol and saturated fat that provides that structural rigidity that the cellular membranes need in order to protect the contents of the cell from the external environment.
I've heard it once analogized that an astute observer, looking at destructive fires, might notice that whenever there's a fire, there's a tremendous amount of water damage. And hence, it might be suspected that the destruction is caused by water and
yes.
not by fire. And,
yes.
This is similar. I mean, Judy Moore uses a similar analogy with firefighters. You know, whenever there are firefighters present, things just tend to burn down. So to implicate firefighters or water as the cause of the problem would be correlation, but not causation.
Yes, exactly. It's a very good analogy. And of course, cholesterol is used as the raw material for making vitamin D, and also the raw material for all of the steroidal hormones, pregnenolone, progesterone, testosterone, estrogen, cortisol. Cholesterol is also the raw material for the bile acids to digest fats. And more recently, we've discovered that cholesterol is used in the key cellular signaling mechanism. So, if you like, the intelligence of the cell. And also, cholesterol plays an important role in the immune system. So, certain cells of the body, even though all cells of the body require cholesterol, certain cells we know require more. And the ones that require more are the cells to do with the brain and the nervous system, and white blood cells to do with the immune system. Also, cholesterol is used in the production of new neurons in the developing brain. So we can see already, and I'm sure there's additional functions for cholesterol that we simply haven't discovered yet.
And that's particularly disconcerting because it's now being recommended in the United States. I don't know about the National Health Service back in England, but I'm sure there's statin fervor over there as well, maybe to a lesser extent because it's perhaps less commercially driven. But it's being recommended that we screen all kids for cholesterol. And if they have high cholesterol, they now have chewable statin medications for kids who can't swallow pills. So what could be the potential downsides of lowering cholesterol dramatically in kids who are maturing sexually and neurologically?
Yeah, well, I mean, that it's just a disaster waiting to happen. Obviously, cholesterol is just so critically important for the developing brain and the nervous system. It's just unthinkable to try and block the production of cholesterol within a young person. There are all kinds of implications, and one thing which is not that widely known is that low cholesterol levels is strongly correlated with an increased risk of suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
I think violent behavior and accidents for some reason too.
Yes.
The sort of bad endings may be associated with low cholesterol.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So there was a study published in Epidemiology in 2001, and they found that people with the lowest cholesterol levels had six times more risk of committing suicide.
Wow.
So that, I think that's, one indication as to how important cholesterol is for the brain.
Okay, so let's switch gears then to the statin part of this equation, because cholesterol, it's questionable whether cholesterol is the end all and be all, the determinant of cardiovascular risk. I think we've established that. But then let's take a look at the proposition: is the widespread application of statin drugs warranted? Now I'm going to say this up front. As a physician trained in conventional medicine, I recognize that there's some circumstances where, frankly, statins may help to prevent cardiovascular disease, particularly in what's called secondary prevention. If you've had a heart attack, if you've had a blockage which has been treated with bypass surgery or a stent where your arteries are damaged and very quickly they can close up again, frankly, I mean, you got to admit, Justin, there are studies that show that it can help to prevent a second cardiovascular event. So what do you say to that?
Yes, I mean, in general, I would agree. So but first of all, the primary prevention population, because, of course, that includes around 75% of all the people who take a statin at the moment. So for those people, in all of the clinical trials that have been completed, they never have been able to demonstrate any actual extension in life expectancy. So there may be a slight reduction in the risk of suffering a heart attack or stroke, and typically the risk may be reduced by 1 or 2% in absolute terms.
Well, that's interesting because there's, and I think you're aware of this, there's this thing called NNT, number needed to treat, in medicine. Yeah. And if you look at that, that's very fascinating because a lot of people will say, hey, you know, that's great. You know, I'll take any kind of reduction. I might as well take it. These things are pretty innocuous. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when I go out on my bicycle, I wear a bike helmet. I don't intend to crash. There's a very small likelihood that I'll crash. But if I crash, I want to make sure that I have a helmet on. So even though very, very small likelihood, I'm still going to do it. What do the statistics mean when we talk about number needed to treat?
Well, the Cochrane collaboration did a meta-analysis not that long ago of statin clinical trials, and they concluded that you would have to treat in primary prevention around 1,000 people for 1 year to prevent one death. And they said that the numbers were so large in terms of looking at it like that, that there may even be no real benefit at all. That could just be down to chance.
So conversely, 999 people would be unnecessarily taking it. And that'd be fine, I guess, if it didn't cost anything. I mean, you know, we don't want to throw people under the bus because the drugs are too expensive. But we are, you know, both our economies, Great Britain, United States, are facing some severe challenges when it comes to medical expenses. And number two, these drugs are not innocuous. There are side effects.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And I would say, first of all, you know, if you look at the data for all-cause mortality, then from my point of view, there's no net benefit anyway, because that 1 or 2% that you might reduce the risk for heart attack or a stroke, then you lose that anyway, because somewhere the statin medication is increasing the risk for other serious diseases.
Right. And so, I think that's a very important point to make. Excuse me for interrupting here. But, you know, the most important thing to look at whenever you're taking medication that prevents something, say you're taking a drug to prevent prostate cancer. Great. Okay. Or a better example with prostate cancer is the surgery that is done for prostate cancer. Unfortunately, some of the studies are showing that if you get the aggressive treatment for prostate cancer, you may be less likely to die of prostate cancer, but you're not less likely to die. And in fact, you may be more likely to have poor quality of life on your way to dying.
Yes, exactly. And in Statin Nation, we have Dr. Malcolm Kendrick, who's the author of The Great Cholesterol Con, and he's a senior doctor here in the UK. And he sums it up quite well by saying that you might change what's written on the death certificate, but you don't change the date.
Mm-hmm. That's well said.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing is the other adverse effects associated with statins.
Well, let's run down some of those because, I recall a few years back on the Today Show, which is America's most popular morning show. They had a guy who was a representative of the American Heart Association, very big shot cardiologist, talking about statin drugs and talking about how important it was to get the word out that people who need these drugs should be taking them, i.e., you know, probably the majority of Americans. And what he was saying is these drugs have revolutionized our treatment of heart disease. Not enough people are taking them. And when it came to the question of side effects, he said the side effects are exceedingly rare. Perhaps less than 1 in 1,000. And this was several years ago, and maybe some of the side effects weren't recognized then, but I just shook my head and I said, this guy is either in complete denial or else he's outright lying and shilling for the pharmaceutical firms, because we know that the side effects are much more pervasive than that.
Yes, exactly. And I think part of this goes back to this fundamental problem that the research, 80% of the research is done by the pharmaceutical companies, so they then control how the data gets published, what gets published and what doesn't get published. For example, in the Cochrane collaboration review that I mentioned earlier, they included 14 clinical trials on statin medications, and they reported that half of those clinical trials didn't report on the adverse effects at all.
Sure.
So you know, there's a lot of data that's missing that we simply don't know in terms of adverse effects.
Well, the other problem is, I mean, frankly, some of these effects are rather subtle. So if a patient comes in to see a doctor and they're on a statin, and, you know, they report the usual things. They say, you know, doc, my memory is just not what it used to be. And the doctor will say, you know, what do you expect? I mean, you're 49, you're 62, you know, menopausal women have that problem, et cetera, et cetera. Or they'll say, you know, I'm feeling tired, doc. And the doctor will say, hey, you know, I was just thinking that myself. I'm slowing down and, you know, I'm taking these statin drugs myself. And I don't know, you get a little older and, you know, you still feel that pep and vigor. It's to be expected. Or alternatively, you know, I'm achy, my legs hurt. Well, you know, that's what happens when you get past a certain age. These side effects sometimes are subtle and they're sort of buried among the usual complaints of aging.
Exactly. I think that's a very important point. And it's also something that Dr. Peter Langston talks about in Statin Nation. Dr. Langston's a cardiologist in Texas, Tyler in Texas, and an expert on coenzyme Q10. And he describes that how they're insidious because normally adverse effects show up quite quickly, but you might be sort of a delay of 6 months or more before you see any significant adverse effects.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe, from my experience anyway, that if you're experiencing serious problems with a statin drug, that simply by taking coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol, that you're going to ameliorate that. I mean, maybe you'll take the edge off the side effects, but I don't think you can completely counteract the side effects, no matter if you take a boatload of that stuff.
No, I don't think so. I think there's a huge variation between in different individual people.
Yes, it seems to be genetic, yeah.
Yes, but because I'm a member of various forums on the internet with if there's thousands of people who have had their lives literally ruined by taking statin medications. And for most of these people, they've been taking coenzyme Q10 and a whole sort of barrage of other supplements as well, but you know, their progress is very, very slow, even though they stopped taking the statin medication sometimes years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's a much bigger problem than most people realize. And if we would sort of run through the official list of
yes.
officially recognized adverse effects, the main ones associated with statins, then it's depression, suicide, sleep disturbances, memory loss, sexual dysfunction, lung disease, muscle-related problems, cognitive loss, neuropathy, pancreatic dysfunction, and liver dysfunction. And we now know that statins actually cause type 2 diabetes, and there's also increased risks for acute kidney injury. Even more worryingly, fairly recently, there was a study published to show that in women, if women take statins for 10 years, that doubles their risk for breast cancer.
Wow. So, you know, I understand that you yourself, you're a competitive cyclist. There's like a huge renaissance of cycling over there in England. You know, congratulations on the Tour de France victories. And, some of your guys are really cleaning up.
Yes.
But you know, as an athlete and as a cyclist, I'm sure you recognize that one of the potential side effects, I mean, they're recommending statins for a lot of healthy guys in their 40s and 50s who, you know, they're weekend warriors, they're active, they're trying to stay in the game. And there's been some really disturbing news about animal studies that show that virtually all animals tested when placed on statin drugs tend to run shorter distances, they use the treadmill less, they're less fast, regardless of the statin dosage.
Yes, exactly. And there's also a study done on people to show that statins block the benefits of exercise. So normally, of course, when you take exercise, there's an adaptive response, mm-hmm. so the body gets fitter and stronger, of course. Now, that response isn't really seen in people who take statin medications. something about the statin that prevents that adaptive improvement to take place.
Well, that's crazy, because one of the most important things that happens after you have a heart attack is you go into something called cardiac rehab. At first, you know, you train very carefully under supervision, you go really slow, and then you work up your exercise capacity. Virtually all these people are on statin medications plus a host of other drugs. And what you're saying is that the exercise that's supposed to help them revascularize and build up their heart muscle again is less efficacious when they're on the statin.
Absolutely, yes, yes. It's a big, big issue, yes. Yes.
Wow.
And another interesting point is there was a study done by University of Texas, and, you know, obviously we've all been kind of brainwashed to believe that the LDL particles are the bad guys, the bad cholesterol. Well, they actually found that with people who took physical exercise, the people who gained more muscle mass were the people who had higher levels of LDLs. So the LDLs actually helped them to adapt to the exercise and get more benefits from it.
Wow, that's interesting. That's something I hadn't even heard. So, you know, I don't know what the situation is in England. I believe the United States may be the only country in the, quote, Western world or among advanced nations that allows direct-to-consumer advertising for drugs. And we frequently turn on the TV and see advertisements for statin drugs. And the main theme of these advertisements is, you know, they usually show healthy young individuals doing active things. And the message that they're trying to get across is you may think that you're in good health, but you never know. You could be hanging by a thread. You could be highly at risk for a heart attack. And so think again. Don't be in denial. Take that, you know, you have life insurance. You know, you do all kinds of safe things in your life. Make sure you take these protective medications. Ask your doctor, or these days they say ask your health provider about whatever, Lipitor or Zocor. And the message is to create a great deal of insecurity among relatively healthy people. A recent study shows that this direct-to-consumer advertisement is not having the desired effect. It's not getting people who really need or stand to benefit from statins on statins. It's getting a lot of people who are healthy and might have the least likelihood of benefiting from statins to use these expensive medications with side effects.
Yes, I can imagine. Well, imagine that's the case. Yes, I know the direct to consumer advertising is a huge problem for you guys over there. We here in the UK, of course, we don't have that particular problem, but there are all kinds of other things in place that keep the statin prescriptions coming out. It's things like the guidelines that are set by our health authorities.
So NICE, it's called NICE over there.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah,
that's a great acronym. It's NICE. It's nice to set guidelines and basically ration health care and tie doctors' hands and constrain them to prescribe certain things.
Yes, absolutely. And so NICE are the organization over here that are supposed to calculate whether a medication is cost effective to use or not.
Mm-hmm.
And then they give the guidelines out to general practitioners, to physicians. And when you look at the document to justify the use of statins, you can see that in their calculation, they conveniently ignored the fact that statins in primary prevention have never been shown to extend life. So in their calculation, they only look at the slight benefit that's been shown for the reduction in heart attacks and strokes, ignoring the fact that people don't live any longer. So there's obviously, you know, some other serious diseases being caused. The other thing that they don't put into their calculation is the cost associated with the adverse effects. And the best estimates suggest that around 20% of people who take a statin medication are going to suffer significant adverse effects, which, of course, would also drain the health system and obviously have a huge cost associated with that. So NICE have a nice way of doing things when it suits them, you know, to do their calculation for cost effectiveness.
Well, we're quick to follow in your heels because we're going to emulate NICE in the United States as part of Obamacare. They're setting up something called IPAB, the Independent Practice Advisory Board, something to that effect. Which is a group of appointed experts who are going to decide on what's right for Americans in terms of medication. Now, I mean, as a physician, I'd like to exercise my independent judgment. And in many cases, I withhold statin medications from patients who otherwise might be considered candidates for statin medications. But under the new guidelines force doctors' hands. And oh, by the way, we've got a very robust liability system, especially in this country, where if, God forbid, something bad happens to a patient, patients have a nasty way of going south sometimes, and better they should be on a statin drug because that would be the correct treatment. And if they're not, that might result in litigation.
Yes, it's kind of the same here in that it might not be litigation, but because NICE issued these guidelines to doctors, then of course doctors are obliged to follow these guidelines. And they also are used to determine, we have something over here called the Quality and Outcomes Framework, which is like a performance-related pay for doctors. Hmm. So you have these kind of thresholds set for different kind of biomarkers, if you like. And of course, you have a certain cholesterol level that doctors, for certain population groups, doctors are expected to bring the cholesterol levels down below the specified value.
Well, so you get like bonus points and salary incentives.
Absolutely.
if your patient's cholesterol is lower.
Absolutely. So yes, you get more points and then you get more money from the government.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yes,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I
wish I could get that for improving patients' cholesterol profiles. Yes. With diet and lifestyle.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Then people's health would genuinely be benefited.
Right.
One of the other problems here in the UK is we have NICE, which does the calculation for cost effectiveness, but the MHRA is a separate government organization that decides whether a medication is safe to use in the first place. And most people think that this organization is completely independent.
Right.
And they don't know that this organization is funded by the application fee that the drugs companies pay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's
a pay-to-play operation. And,
yes.
In effect, a form of crony capitalism, because, the people look at the British system, they say, well, that's socialized medicine. But there's tremendous interpenetration with big pharma and corporate interests.
Yes, absolutely. And, we have this policy in place over here where everyone above the age of 40 is being called in to see their doctor for a health MOT,
right,
for a general health checkup.
Which they want to institute here too, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and of course, doctors here are under a huge amount of pressure from all directions. And on average, I think the consultation time over here is about 6 to 8 minutes. So really, realistically, what can a doctor do in that 6 to 8 minutes in this so-called health checkup?
Right.
I can't see how they can do anything but prescribe a few medications just to bring people's numbers down to some arbitrary threshold. So then they'll keep their performance-related pay points to a certain standard, and all the authorities happy.
Well, so should we just succumb to nihilism? About this, cholesterol doesn't matter.
I think it's very, very difficult to draw any meaningful correlation between a person's cholesterol level and their risk for cardiovascular disease. And also, it's the cholesterol level at any point in time is affected by so many different factors. So we know that people's cholesterol levels tend to be higher in the winter and lower in the summer.
Yep.
And we know that cholesterol levels are very quickly affected by stress levels. There was a study done on a group of accountants, and they monitored their cholesterol levels and also got them to fill out a questionnaire and to see how stressed they were at the time when the cholesterol test was taken. And there was a very, very clear correlation between how stressed they felt and their current cholesterol level.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's an April 15th in England, but that's the time when accountants really get busy around here. It's a cyclical thing.
Yes, exactly. That's what they found. Of course, when it got close to publishing or auditing accounts, then of course the stress levels went up and the cholesterol levels went up. Mm-hmm. And the difference was so much that it literally would make the difference between being below the threshold, the so-called ideal threshold, being below it or way above it, just based on how stressed the person felt during that particular week. So I think so many things can affect cholesterol levels, and it's very difficult to say for an individual person whether it's better for them to have a higher or a lower level. The other thing that we kind of haven't covered so much is the so-called bad cholesterol, the LDLs.
Yep.
And so many resources are put into lowering these bad cholesterol levels. You'd think that there is a huge amount of data out there to show this so-called linear relationship. So the higher your LDL level is, then the higher your risk for heart disease. But there isn't any evidence to support that at all. There isn't any published data to show that relationship. In fact, what is published shows the opposite. So there was a study published in 2009 in the American Heart Journal, and they looked at it was a huge population, and they looked at a huge group of people who had been admitted to hospitals in the United States with heart disease. And they found that people with heart disease had an LDL level of 104, so the average was 104. But at the same time, the LDL level for the general population was 123.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually found that people with heart disease had lower levels of so-called bad cholesterol. So, this study should have ended the whole cholesterol campaign instantly. But because of the commercial interest, there was no press release issued to support the results. So the media and the journalists wouldn't be aware of it. And so it just kind of slipped underneath the radar, and very few people have actually seen it.
Well, then another way of putting my question is, if cholesterol is not the end all and be all and statins are of very limited utility, what's a person to do to safeguard themselves from the leading cause of death in the West, which is heart disease?
Well, I think it's a real shame that so many resources have been directed at cholesterol lowering, and there isn't any evidence that that's actually helping anyone. So there was a study published in Norway, and they looked at in Sweden, they looked at pretty much all the different regions of Sweden, and found that even though the prescription of statin medications had drastically increased, there was no evidence that there was any benefit associated with that. And here in the UK, when you look at the actual death rate from heart disease, there's no change in the curve. So the number of people dying of heart disease has been reducing since the 1970s. And statins were introduced around 1995, widely used. They started to be widely used around 1995. But at that point, there's been no change in this reduction in the death rate. So there's no evidence that statins are providing any benefit, or cholesterol lowering is providing any benefit. So it's been a huge waste of money and resources. Now, if we look at what the real causes of heart disease are, then I think, first of all, we need to change the way we look at the disease from this idea of things, cholesterol and fat, simply clogging up the arteries, and look at it from a more realistic point of view in terms of what's actually damaging the inside wall of the arteries. And when we look at that, then we can see that heart disease is mostly an inflammatory condition. And there are many things, of course, that could cause or contribute to that inflammatory process. One of the key things that I try to tell people about is a high level of blood glucose. So what's happened is all this misinformation to reduce the amount of fat and cholesterol in our diets has, of course, led people to reduce the fat but increase the amount of sugar and carbohydrates, which has meant that their people's blood glucose levels have increased quite a lot. And we know that when the blood glucose level is too high, that can cause inflammation within the arteries. And also, high levels of blood glucose can inhibit nitric oxide. So nitric oxide, of course, is responsible for widening the arteries to allow better circulation. And we know that when blood glucose is too high, it actually inhibits this process and inhibits the nitric oxide. So the most important thing, the most fundamental thing that anyone can do is just forget this whole idea that we need to avoid fat and cholesterol and go back to a traditional wholesome diet that includes a balance of all the food groups. In particular, each meal should be made up of meat or fish and vegetables, or poultry and vegetables. This sort of healthy, balanced diet in itself would make a huge difference to people's health.
And, of course, exercise being an important part of the equation. And how do you monetize that? The pharmaceutical industry, I don't think, is going to be too happy that we're abandoning what is considered the most revolutionary fix for cardiovascular disease that's ever hit the scene, which is this, you know, new drug intervention.
Yes. And, you know, I understand that it can be very difficult for people to implement lifestyle changes, but even a small change, a small improvement in lifestyle, so slightly improving diet, getting more good quality nutrients into the body, just taking, even if it's just 15, 20 minutes exercise, you know, 4 or 5 times a week, that would make a huge difference, be much, much more positive than a toxic statin medication.
Justin, you know, in conclusion, I just want to ask, you know, you're an iconoclast, you know, you're spreading the word on this. Your views may not be too popular in the medical establishment. Have you received any pushback from medical authorities over there in England?
No, so far I haven't, no. The only thing is, you know, as probably understandable, when making the documentary, none of the health authorities would be willing to be interviewed. You know, they made silly excuses like, we don't have the time, we get requests like this all the time. But in reality, you know, there's no other documentary being made on this subject. So, you know, they clearly aren't getting lots of requests. They just know that there are some key fundamental questions that they simply can't provide answers to.
So the website is statinnation.net, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And the DVD is available for purchase through the website. I recommend it very highly. It's called Statin Nation. And Justin writes a blog, and he's got lots of useful information posted at statinnation.net. Justin Smith, thank you very much for joining us on today's Intelligent Medicine podcast, and congratulations on your great work, and thanks for taking up the cause, because I think we need your point of view to be as well articulated as you have in the DVD, Statin Nation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.